The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the past few weeks, North Carolina's so-called bathroom law has put gender identity and trans rights into the national spotlight.
We want to spend a few more minutes now on that controversial bathroom law that's gotten so much attention in North Carolina, or HB2.
What's gotten the most attention is a requirement that schools and government offices restrict bathrooms to the gender a person is born
with.
This
past week, President Obama wrote a letter telling every public school district in the country to let transgender students use the bathrooms that match their gender identity. At the center of the controversy is a question of safety.
A quick primer here. Biological sex is what is on your birth certificate. Gender identity, which may or may not correspond, does not develop for years. For people who have had little to no exposure to the trans experience, the issue has come out of nowhere. But Jessica Winters isn't too surprised. She says society is reinforcing gender norms incorrectly, even before babies are born.
Have you all voted?
That's a clip from a viral gender reveal party video. Jessica Winter is features editor for Slate. In a recent article, she connected the rise of the gender reveal party to North Carolina's HB2 law. Jessica, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So for folks who have not seen one, what is a gender reveal party?
Gender reveal party is usually based around a gender reveal cake. And sometimes the parents will find out the sex of the fetus and make a cake that either has a pink interior or a blue interior, and then they cut it open at the party and reveal the sex of their soon-to-be baby to the celebrants. I think more often the parents themselves want to be surprised, and so they have their OBGYN or the sonogram technician just write the sex on a piece of paper. They slip it to a trusted baker, and then the baker can make the cake so that everyone is surprised at the party.
So they can be pretty creative, and for better or for worse, I guess I would say. What are some of the themes of these gender reveal parties?
I mean, some of these gender reveal parties are gorgeous affairs. There are cakes that you see that will have the tagline, who will I be open to see? And the cake is designed as this gorgeous package to be opened. And maybe there's pink wrapping inside and maybe there's blue. There are others that are a little more questionable. Some of the taglines might be rifles or ruffles, meaning if it's a boy, it's a rifle. And if it's a girl, it's a ruffle. Another one you see a lot is guns or glitter. And these are the ones that make me a little uncomfortable because they seem to assign boys with kind of violence and action and can-do-ness, and they assign girls kind of frilly embellishments and not a whole lot in the way of action. And, you know, you kind of want to just roll your eyes at it, but they're very popular, and they definitely reinforce these kind of gender norms that I don't think are particularly healthy.
Well, here's one growing trend. Couples pack a little box of explosive pink or blue chalk and then shoot it with a high-powered rifle. Let's hear a clip from YouTube.
Yeah, go. Fire in the hole. That was sweet.
So the title of the party is maybe a little misleading. They're not really revealing gender, but sex, right?
Right. They're revealing biological chromosomal sex. I mean, chances are they are revealing gender. Generally speaking, sex and gender do correspond. But as we're learning, they don't always.
And maybe reveal more about what people think about gender. I mean, after such a public performance, it makes me wonder if there are expectations of how a child will behave.
I think so. And I think this is especially interesting with very little kids, like kids under the age of maybe 2 or 2.5. Those kids don't know what gender is. They don't have any inkling of what gender presentation might be or whether they're a boy or a girl. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, but generally speaking, kids are just clueless about that until a certain age. And so I think it's more about parents projecting onto the children than actually guessing anything about the children.
Well, you're a mother of a daughter, I believe, young daughter. What does being a parent reveal to you about how people view gender and sex in kids and babies?
I think the thing that's most striking to me, and I wrote about this a little bit in Slate, is if I've dressed my daughter, who's 18 months old, in, say, jeans and a T-shirt because we're going to the playground, people automatically assume she's a boy. And I never correct anyone because I don't care. But if they realize their mistake, they tend to be very apologetic, as if they've offended me somehow. Sometimes people are a little affronted that I have not signposted her as a girl more clearly, that I haven't put bows in her hair or I haven't put her in a pink dress. That speaks to me about a certain uneasiness we have about sex and gender in our culture that may or may not be expressed in these gender reveal parties as well.
Jessica Winter is with us. She's features editor for Slate. She wrote recently about the rise of the gender reveal party and how these parties relate to a somewhat deterministic view of gender in American culture. So when people ask if a child is a boy or a girl, I mean, do you think that's deterministic? Do you think that's the wrong question to ask?
I think it's rude. I hated it when strangers came up to me and asked me that question when I was pregnant, when I was visibly pregnant. And it's not because I was offended that they were blurring the line between sex and gender or any of that. I was offended because I did not like the idea of becoming public property because I was visibly pregnant. And I think that there is a parallel there with the bathroom controversy, because it's both of these situations are about the struggle to achieve privacy in public. A visibly pregnant woman doesn't have much privacy in public. A trans person who wants to use the right bathroom in North Carolina doesn't have much privacy in public because lawmakers are interrogating his or her right to do that. And so I think that's another strain here that we need to look at. I also I hasten to add, though, that I think my experience was colored by living in New York City, where you just try to keep that tunnel vision and you don't really want to have a whole lot of impromptu interactions with strangers, particularly about your body.
Another part of our culture is how toys and clothing for boys and girls are marketed, often separated into binary aisles. How do clothing and toy marketers and manufacturers play into these gender expectations?
Well, I think we see that that's changing. I think a leader in that regard is Target. Target has definitely made an effort and received some backlash for the effort to kind of tamp down a little bit on the boy stuff and the girl stuff as signposted in their aisles. They introduced the Pillow Fort line of mostly gender-neutral home goods and linens for kids. So I do think that is changing. On the other hand, if gender reveal parties are becoming a bigger and bigger trend, then companies and manufacturers are going to glom onto that trend, just as they glommed onto every other trend in the baby industrial complex, whether it was the baby shower, the baby sprinkle, the push present, that was a big thing a few years ago, the baby moon. This is just another entrant in the category of how to get parents to be to spend money.
How does this trend relate to the HB2 controversy for you?
I think it's exceedingly rare that anyone would have a gender reveal party to kind of stick it to the trans rights movement. That is not what I think. That's not what I was trying to say in the piece. I do think that when fundamental cultural norms are being questioned, the way they are being questioned by the trans rights civil rights movement, I think social and cultural anxieties start percolating and bubbling up in really interesting ways. And it doesn't strike me as a coincidence that gender reveal parties are going viral at the same time that we're having this debate over whether or not people can use the bathroom that's right for them in North Carolina.
I was looking at one of the chalk exploding gender reveal photo shoots, along with some pointed critiques and heated arguments that followed in the comments threads. and thought, is it unfair to rain on an unexpected couple's parade by criticizing their gender enthusiasm, let's say, or if even posting that party footage online, they are inviting the debate?
I mean, I think the most important distinction to draw is between the personal and the cultural. I don't have any personal objections to people having gender reveal celebrations. If it floats your boat, if it makes your family happy, that's great. I think that can be made distinct from saying, this is a very interesting cultural expression of a cultural anxiety, and let's talk about that and think about that. In terms of people leaving nasty comments online, that's just what people do. People will find any opportunity to leave a nasty comment online, so I don't think that's particular to this specific debate.
So, Jessica, if invited to a gender reveal party, would you go?
Sure. I'd bring a present, and I would whoop with joy when the cake was cut, because that's what the parents wanted. And presumably, if I were invited to this party, they would be my friends, and I would want them to be happy. And I would just hope that they hadn't read the piece I'd already written about it.
Jessica Winter is features editor for Slate. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You can check out her article, Are You a Boy or a Girl? There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd like to know what you think. Did you or someone you know have a gender reveal party? Is that just another eye-rolling part of the baby industrial complex, or a fun tradition or excuse to have some friends over? What, if anything, crosses the line when it comes to celebrating sex or gender? You can let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you want to know how the technology sector is faring, follow its ebbs and flows on the stock market. If you want to know what lies ahead for the industry, you have to get on the inside and take a careful look at ping pong sales in Silicon Valley. Zusha Ellenson covers the West Coast for The Wall Street Journal, where he wrote about the connection between ping pong and tech companies. Zusha, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what is the Ping Pong Table Index?
Well, the Ping Pong Table Index will soon be one of the most serious indices looked at by investors and venture capitalists alike, no doubt.
I'm sure.
Yes, but I'll tell you how it all started. We here in the Bay Area, you know, you occasionally go to tech companies for interviews, for whatnot, and we started noticing that every tech company seemed to have a ping pong table in it. And we wondered, you know, if we could start to track the tech economy by looking at how many ping pong tables were being sold in the Bay Area.
So you and your crack investigative team went to?
So, yeah, we undertook a very serious investigation, and we called a local ping pong table wholesaler. And after much cajoling, he was willing to share his sales data. So we were able to look at how many ping pong tables he had sold over the past 2 years. And this guy, his name is Simon Ng. He's located in the heart of Silicon Valley, and he sells ping pong tables to all the name brand tech companies you've heard of, to Yahoo, to Twitter, to Google, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we did is we took all his sales data, and we were wondering, well, would it match up with the Silicon Valley tech economy? And there's a couple different ways to look at the tech economy, and one of the ways is to look at venture capital funding. This is all the money going from venture capitalists to startups. And we found that there was somewhat of a correlation between venture funding and ping pong table sales.
So how's it doing? Is there a tech bubble about to burst? I mean, Twitter did not have a very good first quarter.
That's right. So the first quarter was troublesome to investors, and also venture capital funding started to dry up a little. And what we found is that ping pong table sales were indeed down in the first quarter of this year, down 50% from the fourth quarter of last year, which almost mirrors the amount of venture capital funding going out to startups.
Well, besides being such a scientific indicator, what is the symbolic power of a ping pong table? What does that communicate in Silicon Valley?
Well, I think, you know, it's funny, when you live out here in the Bay Area, these things become so normal, but then to most of the rest of the country, I guess they're not that normal. Silicon Valley, you know, they want to rebel against their father's type of company. You know, they don't wear suits, all that sort of stuff. And one of the things that they've done is they want to make the workplace fun, quote unquote. And they bring in games such as pool, foosball, and for some reason, ping pong has become sort of every tech company has got to have a ping pong table. We even quoted one CTO of a software as a service company, and he said, "You are not a tech company unless you have a ping pong table."
Wow. So which companies are seeing a decline in sales of buying ping pong tables, I should say?
So it was really funny. I was sitting in the office with this guy, Simon Ng, and I wanted to, you know, wanted to sort of test out our theory. And so I would throw out tech company names, and I would ask him sort of when was the last, you know, were they buying a lot of ping pong tables? When was the last time they had bought a ping pong table? And whether we could tell how well that company was doing. And so we threw out the names, and I threw out the name Yahoo, which everyone knows is, you know, struggling a lot in recent years. And he said, "Well, they haven't bought a ping pong table in a long time." Now, to be fair, we called up Yahoo, and they assured us that people are still playing ping pong at Yahoo, and in fact had bought ping pong tables at some of their offices around the country, although not at their headquarters in Sunnyvale. In contrast to that, Google, which is ever-expanding and has been doing quite well, had just bought a bunch of ping pong tables. So we figure, you know, if you're an investor, do you want to know what's really happening at the big tech companies, you can just take a look at ping pong table sales, too.
Okay, how's Intel doing?
Intel, which announced a bunch of layoffs, as you know, had stopped buying stuff from Mr. Ng about a year ago, he said. We unfortunately did not hear back from Intel to get a full explanation.
Why ping pong, Zusha, not darts or foosball?
Well, it's interesting. We talked to sort of resident scholars of Silicon Valley, and they said during the first dot-com boom that pool was more popular. And for some reason, you know, it's always this whole idea of being informal, having fun at work, with sort of the dark underside of trying to keep your employees at work as long as possible by having them play games. But this time around, during this boom, ping pong has gained in popularity, and there's a couple different theories about that. One theory is that entrepreneurs have become more savvy and more thrifty because the ping pong tables don't cost as much as pool tables, mm-hmm. and they can be used for meeting tables. In fact, we found many startups use the ping pong tables for meetings, actually, which is quite funny. And there's even a company that makes meeting tables that turn into ping pong tables as well. Mr. Ng, he thought that companies were trying to appeal to their Chinese and Indian employees, where, you know, it's very popular over in Asia. So that was his theory on why ping pong has become so popular. So we went to a couple of tech firms just to sort of see how they felt about ping pong. And we found that a lot of the tech firms that we visited, they have internal rankings even. So they'll like have tournaments, and they'll have the number one ping pong player in their office and all this sort of stuff, and they keep track of it in little spreadsheets. So they're very passionate about it. And then there's leagues where the tech companies play each other, and there's tournaments. It's quite intense, actually.
Well, Zusha, I'm wondering if there are any other indicators that might track the success or solvency of tech companies, you know, like number of vegan meals offered or meditation coaches. What's next?
Well, yeah, we put that question to the experts, and some said, well, they thought it could be better explained by a foosball index, and some others said, well, what about an Odwalla index? So a lot of tech companies provide free snacks, including these little Odwalla juices, so maybe you could track Odwalla sales. There was some suggestion about Kind bars, which are these healthy candy bars that are provided as snacks at tech companies as well. So we feel there's a couple. You know, we could maybe put together a basket of goods, as it were, that track the tech economy. You know, maybe you have your Odwalla juice, you have your Kind bar, you have your ping pong table. You can really start to get into it.
Well, Zusha, thank you for sharing it here with us. So now we know what to watch.
Thanks for having me.
Zusha Ellenson covers the West Coast for The Wall Street Journal. And you'll find a link to read his article, "Is the High-Tech Bubble Popping? Ping Pong Offers an Answer." There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. We'll be right back.
Mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In a 2012 live event in Silicon Valley, Elon Musk, founder of SpaceX and Tesla Motors, proposed an idea for a supersonic form of ground travel called the Hyperloop. Cheaper and way faster than high-speed rail, Musk said this so-called fifth mode of travel could run from LA to San Francisco in just 30 minutes. Flash forward 4 years, and this technology is starting to look more like a reality than science fiction. But what the heck is it, and can the promise pay off? Well, Rob Fleischman is principal architect at Akamai and the guy we invite on the show when we do not understand new tech. So hello, Rob.
Hey, it's great to be here, Virginia.
Glad to have you. So what is this thing that Elon Musk proposed in 2012? How does it work?
Okay, well, here's the idea. You have this tube, and you suck all the air out of it. So you make a vacuum. And by doing that, you reduce the friction and resistance of things that travel down the tube. So if you think about it in a large scale, you have a giant tube. You have some kind of pod or sled or small spacecraft, if you will, that you put in the tube. And you move the spacecraft down the tube at incredibly high speeds. And that's sort of the simplest explanation. I mean, if you imagine long ago, there used to be those pneumatic tubes
right at the bank
or at old buildings. You know, if you watch Mad Men, there might be one of those in the building, you know, and you have these little canisters that you stick in the tube and boink, away they go. Imagine doing that with people, except horizontally. That's sort of the
big
idea.
Big, big scale.
Yes, a very big tube. I mean, we're talking about, you know, tubes that might be 24 feet in diameter and hundreds of miles long and speeds that, you know, are Mach 1, Mach 2. I mean, you know, Mach 2 is, you know, 1,500 miles an hour. You know,
oh, my God. I was reading 760.
Yeah, 760, that's about Mach 1, you know. So we're talking about really, really fast speeds. The idea is that by pulling a vacuum, you have a nice, smooth ride. It's quiet. It's fast. And, you know, you set this Hyperloop up between two cities that require people going back and forth a lot. And you supposedly have some transportation efficiency there. And, you know, Elon's, you know, he's a moonshot kind of guy. He loves disruptive things. So this idea, you know, we all think it's kind of sexy because it's great to look at rail and transportation and say, oh, look how old and slow and inefficient and how uninnovative those sectors are.
But we have not had commercial hypersonic passenger travel since the Concorde. Well, remind us of what happened to that.
Well, the Concorde was great, right? So the Concorde, if you remember, was this, you know, British Airways jet.
With British and French, right?
British and French, that's right. And it had these little Delta-like wings. It was really cool looking. Had this nose cone that pointed down, and it went Mach 2. I mean, you know, it was 1,500 miles an hour, and it could do, London to New York in 3 hours instead of 8 hours. The problem with the Concorde was that, you know, it was 1976 technology, right? So analog cockpit, I mean, just old stuff. And in 2003, they end-of-lifed it. You could look into the many reasons they did.
After just one big crash,
oh, yeah,
right?
They had the crash, I think, was, you know, this thing was long in the tooth. And after the crash, they decided, you know what? It's a good excuse for us not to do this anymore. It was always unprofitable. Why? Because you couldn't carry enough people on the thing. You know, it was small. It was extremely expensive, so not a lot of people wanted to go on it because the cost was really astronomical. And, you know, it was old. So maintaining it, Airbus, who made the parts, decided, you know what, it doesn't make sense for us to do this anymore, to keep maintaining this old aircraft, so we're going to end of life it.
Well, you mentioned 1976. Now we have made so many advances in aerodynamics and engine efficiency. I mean, Musk himself has said that somebody should update the supersonic jet for air travel. Do you think it can be done?
I think so, but, you know, it becomes a business decision, right? And that also is a great transition into what Hyperloop's being done now, right? So Musk open sourced this, right? Why did he do that? He did it because he saw this as a task that one small company really can't do, much like a hypersonic airplane, right? You really got to have guts and say, we're going to blow all this money, use exotic materials, use advanced tech, and hope we're going to make it all on the back end. That's a really big risk, right? But when you start doing things like when NASA went to the moon, those were done by government agencies, large organizations with many funders. So that's kind of why he open sourced the idea.
And open source meaning they're not his companies aren't pursuing it. They're just opening it up to everybody.
Exactly. He's saying, here's this cool idea. Here's this cool design. If people want to jump on it, they can do that. And I'm not going to hold on to any of the intellectual property.
You know those pneumatic tubes that they use at the bank drive-through? Well, that concept is now being developed for travel on a system called the Hyperloop. It's an enclosed train that could transport people at speeds up to 800 miles an hour. And engineers all over the world are developing the idea. Our techie on call, Rob Fleischman, is here with us to fill us in on what could or could not be the next big thing in transport. So the reason why we're talking about this is that one company apparently made some big news by creating, I don't know, a demo or something of the Hyperloop. What happened the other day?
Right. So Hyperloop One created this test track near Las Vegas. And what they do is they set up a track, a linear track, you know, straight line, and they built a pod and they were able to accelerate it up to, you know, several hundred miles an hour, 1G of acceleration, and were able to deaccelerate it. So they were really demoing the pod, the spacecraft, the vehicle that would be inside the Hyperloop chamber. So they made some really great progress there, and they had a cool demo, and there's some video online, there's some YouTube videos you can watch, but it really is a cool first step, you know, along the way to making this technology a bit more real. Now, cool demo, but quite a ways to go before, you know, you're even putting people on that demo.
Do you know what the estimated cost of the Hyperloop is?
Oh, boy, you know, I've heard.
I think it's $6 to $7 billion.
That's right, billions. And that, I think, is actually a little low, right? And, you know, there are two folks looking at it, this Hyperloop One and this Hyperloop Transport Technologies. I think HTT, the Hyperloop Transport Technologies, is more of a crowdfunding. You know, there are some other folks who have thrown money in, some of the Uber investors. There's a group overseas, the French Rail, that's looking at, they threw $80 million into it. And, you know, you say to yourself, wow, look at all these crazy people throwing money into this thing. Well, you have to remember, right? Let's think about our journey to the moon. A lot of innovation came out of trying to solve that problem. So I sort of look at Hyperloop saying, you know what, maybe we're never going to build here in the U.S. a 24-foot tube that's hundreds of miles long, but by trying to solve that problem, we might solve other problems on the way that help things like maglev trains or high-speed rail or hypersonic flight.
You just brought up that idea that when we wanted to go to the moon, I mean, that was a huge government resource that kind of created a space for people to work on that exclusively. Now, let's look at the will of the people to spend money on things like that, which is not particularly high.
No.
Even getting light rail or commuter rail here in the Northeast Corridor, where a lot of people have pointed out it's really needed, especially between Boston and New Hampshire. There's no political will for that. So how do you make that happen?
Well, you point out a real serious problem here in the U.S., right? It's, you know, zoning and local landowners, especially in densely populated areas like where we are. You know, maybe this works out west where, you know, one guy owns a whole bunch of desert. But here in New Hampshire, my God, you know, you do a one-mile radius, you might run into 100, 200 different landowners. We have trouble up here getting zoning for gas pipelines, right, to supply natural gas. And those pipeline tubes are much smaller than something like the Hyperloop, right? And those pipeline tubes can move up and down and left and right. The Hyperloop, wow, when you're going 800 miles an hour, you can't take a right-hand turn really fast, I can assure you. That's going to be a problem. So it has to be pretty straight, right? It's big, and, you know, I can't imagine the zoning problem. So those are just real-life issues that make this type of innovation difficult to deploy in a lot of areas. And, you know, there are also all kinds of cool physics problems these guys have to solve. Like, okay, Virginia, we're going to put you in this tube, right? And we're going to accelerate you to Mach 1. It might be dark, right, in the tube. How do you feel about going 800 miles an hour in a concrete chamber on the surface? That's a little scary. It's more like a roller coaster, right?
Well, Rob, you're our can-do tech guy. I mean, I'm not hearing that you're that excited about this. But how far along are these companies who are working on this now? I was reading something about some company making progress in Slovakia. So maybe Europe would be the first to have this.
You might be right. Maybe it'll go there. They're making some really great progress in the pods, you know, the actual vehicle, if you will, that's going to go into the tube. There are cool stabilization problems, right? You don't want it, like, flipping around inside the tube. tube, right? There's acceleration problems. How do you get it up to speed? How do you deaccelerate it? So I'm excited by that research. I'm excited that there are 500 engineers that have committed to putting some time into this, kind of in a crowdsource model for engineering. I find that kind of cool, the idea that bringing in all these engineers from across the world to work on one problem, that's really neat. But, you know, am I optimistic? We've talked about technologies in the past, right? In the past, you asked me about Apple Pay. Are we going to see it? And I predicted we'd have it here in Concord. And fortunately, you can go to our local supermarkets here and pay with Apple Pay. So if you ask me the same question, we'd be getting on Hyperloop anytime soon here in the Northeast, I'm going to say the answer to that one's no.
I'm willing to bet. Slovakia, California, you would be the first person on a jet to ride the Hyperloop.
I would be very interested in going for a ride, but more like a roller coaster than a commuter.
Rob Fleischman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Always great to be here.
Rob Fleischman, he is principal architect at Akamai and our word-of-mouth explainer of all things digital. There's more on the Hyperloop at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When it comes to cars, commuters, and congestion, the Los Angeles freeways are notorious. There are some who grumble not only about travel times, but a suspected source, an industrial conspiracy. Roman Mars and 99% Invisible investigate.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars, and this is Eric Malinsky.
Hi, I'm Eric.
Eric is an independent producer in New York City.
Brooklyn, of course, like most public radio producers here.
But before Brooklyn, Eric spent 10 years in Los Angeles.
Yeah, when I was in LA, I used to hear this story pretty often. And the story, it's almost like a fable. LA had this, you know, amazing transportation system called the Red Car. And it was this trolley that covered the entire city. And then after World War II, either Ford or GM bought the Red Car, had it dismantled, and then built this, you know, horrible freeway system that created the sprawl and gridlock of today.
What the hell's a freeway?
8 lanes of shimmering cement running from here to Pasadena. Smooth, safe, fast. Traffic jams will be a thing of the past.
And, you know, the first time I heard the story, I thought, well, that sounds familiar. It must be true. I feel like I've definitely heard this story before.
That's because it's the plot of Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Humor.
Or at least it's the evil scheme that Christopher Lloyd reveals at the end of the movie.
Come on. Nobody's going to drive this lousy freeway when they can take the Red Car for a nickel.
Oh, they'll drive. They'll have to. You see, I bought the Red Car so I could dismantle it.
What the...
This isn't totally ridiculous. Remember the plot of Chinatown, where a Los Angeles mogul was stealing water from Northern California? That actually happened.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
As I learned more about the history of LA, I learned that the Red Car was actually not the victim of a massive conspiracy. The Red Car actually was the conspiracy. The Red Car helped create the sprawl and the gridlock.
To understand how this all came about, we have to go way back to the mid-19th century. A boy named Henry Huntington was born into a middle-class family in upstate New York, but he has a very wealthy uncle named Collis Huntington.
Collis has no kids, and he sort of latches on to his nephew. And, I mean, I assume he must see something in Henry. You know, he thinks this kid can be molded into a businessman, and he's right. And so Collis takes little Henry under his wing. He teaches him everything about the family business, which is railroads.
Jump to 1900. Collis dies, and Henry thinks he's going to inherit the company Southern Pacific.
But the board doesn't want another Huntington in charge, so Henry's out. And he gets a consolation prize, which is $15 million, which back then was about maybe like $400 million today. And he takes his cash, and he goes south to Los Angeles. The city of Los Angeles really shouldn't exist. I mean, because, you know, the LA River was a mess, and it was so prone to flooding, it would actually change its location on the map.
The only decent harbor is Long Beach, but San Diego has a bigger center of commerce.
And downtown LA is like way far to the east.
A disconnected flatland. But where many people saw the desert, robber barons of the late 19th century saw something else, a blank slate.
So the modern city of Los Angeles, as we know it, was created as sort of like a counterweight to San Francisco, which was liberal even back then and had very strong unions. And LA was an open shop. Like a businessman like Henry Huntington had free rein. And he starts by purchasing the biggest transportation system in the city, which was the Los Angeles Railway, otherwise known as LARI. And he incorporates it into a new company called Pacific Electric. I talked to a bunch of historians about this, including Bill Friedrichs, who grew up in Los Angeles.
I have this vague recollection of a streetcar running up and down the main drag, which was Brand Boulevard. And I think I can remember the bell ringing of the streetcar.
Really? What did it sound like?
Ding, ding. I don't know.
Friedrichs actually wrote a book about Henry Huntington.
The key to Henry Huntington's operation was that this was before a lot of regulation in the area. So Henry pretty much decided where development would occur by building a streetcar line out to the area just ahead of development. And most frequently, he was building the streetcar lines out to where he owned the land.
So to put this in modern terms, the red car was kind of like the Kindle. Amazon loses money on the Kindle because they want you to use this e-reader as a portal to buy lots of, you know, bigger stuff on their website. And so the red car was a portal to get you to buy other bigger stuff from Henry Huntington.
Like your entire life.
He never really made money with the Pacific Electric, but it took people out to his subdivisions where he sold them land, frequently sold them water. He controlled some water companies. He also established an electric operation called the Pacific Light and Power Company. It was essentially set up to provide electricity to his trolley cars, but he ended up selling electricity to the city of Los Angeles.
Now, even back then, this was not business as usual.
There are lots of other streetcar developers, but they're much smaller, and they frequently went bankrupt. Other developers owned land, and they'd build a trolley out to some land, but not the immense amount of land that Huntington controlled. So he's sort of a complete package coming down.
So from 1904 to 1913, Huntington opens 500 new subdivisions every year. He controls more than 900 red cars on more than 1,100 miles of track.
That's about 25% more track mileage than New York City has today, 100 years later.
Now, I mean, historically, American cities grow organically in rings, you know, out of a downtown. And Huntington really forces Los Angeles to expand outward at twice the rate. And I think that really weakened downtown LA because he was creating these little downtowns along his trolley routes. So, you know, you think he's creating this empire. He's got the trains, he's got the electricity, he's got the land, he's got the water.
All he needed now were people.
Back then, you know, there are a lot of reasons not to like cities. I mean, they were dirty, they were crowded, they were dangerous. And Los Angeles was going to be this very different kind of city. That was the dream. And Huntington and Harry Chandler and all these other sort of LA power brokers went on this media blitz. And during the winter, they would blanket the Midwest with advertisements, you know, that Los Angeles is a paradise full of orange trees. The climate will cure your asthma. You can go surfing. And surfing was actually a relatively unknown sport until Henry Huntington hired a Hawaiian surfer named George Freeth to surf along Huntington Beach. And it worked. I mean, for a while, Long Beach was known as Iowa by the Sea because so many Iowans lived there.
But eventually, the dream went bust.
So now remember, Pacific Electric is designed to lose money. It's a portal to Huntington's real estate and other companies. And so the board of Pacific Electric is not happy about this. In the meantime, the red car is becoming a threat to Southern Pacific Railroad, which was, you know, the company that Huntington thought he was going to inherit from his uncle. So Southern Pacific wants to buy Pacific Electric. Huntington says no. His own board overrules him. He's forced to make a deal, and once again, his power and his ambitions are cut short.
But Henry Huntington gets the last laugh in a pretty weird way.
Because his uncle's fortune was split between him and his aunt Arabella. So Huntington marries his aunt and consolidates the family fortune. Now, it's actually not quite as icky as it sounds because they were not related by blood. She was his uncle's second wife.
But still.
Yeah. So Huntington actually lives happily ever after with his wealth and his aunt slash wife. And he brings a lot of beauty to Los Angeles. He creates Huntington Gardens, the Huntington Library. He dies in 1927. And I don't know if he knew yet, but it was clear already to historians looking back that the red car was doomed.
Even though the overall track mileage rivaled New York, the red car wasn't comprehensive enough to go everywhere you needed to go by red car alone.
And they started to become poorly maintained. I mean, people started calling them slums on wheels.
The big turning point comes in 1926, a year before Huntington dies. Southern Pacific, which now owns Huntington's Pacific Electric, offers this massive plan to build subways and elevated trains all around downtown LA.
And this would be paid for by the taxpayer, so it's put up for a public referendum. And there's a lot of money spent, you know, a lot of advertising spent on both sides, just like referendums today. And the voters reject the plan.
People just didn't like Southern Pacific. They had meddled in California politics for so long that they called it the octopus.
Okay, so now remember the original sort of conspiracy theory that the car companies bought up the red car and tore them down and built up the freeways. So there was a subsidiary of General Motors called National City Lines, and they did buy trolley cars and they converted them into bus routes. And there were people at the time that thought it was a conspiracy. This wasn't this conspiracy that suddenly, you know, people discovered 50 years later. But the fact is Pacific Electric was doing the same thing to their own trolley cars.
As freeways became the norm and the red car became a thing of the past, you can see how a conspiracy theory could become cemented into the public imagination.
So when I first saw a map of the red car lines, I actually thought it was an early map of the freeways, which makes sense. These are the routes that people were using to get around. And in some cases, like the Cahuenga Pass, trains were actually dismantled to make way for the Hollywood Freeway. Santa Monica Boulevard is paved over a trolley route, and sometimes, you know, when I was heading to the 405, I'd actually drive over these phantom tracks.
LA's first freeway, the Arroyo Seco Parkway, which connects downtown to Pasadena, opened in 1940. A few years later, city planners proposed another plan for elevated railroads that was rejected by the city council. The last red car ran in 1961. And you have to think it was, in a way, a victim of its own success. Henry Huntington's goal was to connect his far-flung properties and create a decentralized city that you'd need a mass transit solution to get around. The problem was, he couldn't provide it. Over time, LA was so spread out that it overtaxed what the red car was capable of servicing.
I like to imagine, you know, if it's 1960 and I'm driving along the 10 freeway, I mean, I'm sure there was traffic, but it must have been pretty smooth. Because, I mean, the freeways that exist now were the same freeways back then, but built for a much smaller population. So they must have seemed like a really impressive solution at the time.
And today, Angelenos can appreciate the great solution of their highway system for hours and hours and hours
and hours
and hours
and hours
and hours
and hours.
Hours.
And that story came to us from Roman Mars, producer Eric Malinsky, and 99% Invisible. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, including the Word of Mouth podcast, which lets you listen on your own time. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth and NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast or have suggestions for us, rate it on iTunes. That'll help others find it when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.